Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Neil and Kristen Baker Psychic Hour. Today, we are taking your calls for on-air psychic readings, numerology readings. Our number 914-338-0164. We hope you call us today. Don't have any callers right now, so we're going to get into our discussion. But first, want to invite everyone to join us on Facebook. Our social media sites are Facebook and Twitter, the Neil and Kristen Baker Psychic Hour, Neil Baker Psychic, and Neil and Kristen Baker, which is our personal page. And if you would like to speak to Neil, or if you would like to speak to Neil and I, 562-596-7818 is the number to call. You'll always be referred back to that number if you want to book a reading with us. Okay, so.
You know, this is our 700 shows now we've done together.
707 is your master number.
Yeah.
And I have a couple sevens in my birth date.
Yeah, yeah. I guess it would take, if you listen to the shows back to back, you know, it would take about a month.
Wow.
To listen to 24 into 7.
That would be a slow form of suicide. Not recommended if you're trying to.
It could be a fast form. You know,
3 months, a month?
Show could you drop
it. Yeah. Maybe 700 shows. Wow.
Yeah. Just about. Yeah. I mean, if you look at it, it's just a little bit shy of 30 days straight back to back. So.
Wow.
That
interesting.
Would be 720 shows.
373. That happens to involve our master numbers.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's exciting. But
it's been a lot. It's been, you know, hopefully we've helped a lot of people and been informative. And basically, our show is, we have topics, but we always go to the callers first because we feel that's most important to help people. But then we like to give out information.
Yeah, and we don't have any callers right now. Should I go get on the upstairs phone and call in?
You could.
And
I won't give you an accurate reading. I might urge you. But, you know, and we were talking about the levels of psychic energy and how
they differ from
changes
day,
from
day
to night.
Night.
And you don't have to be a psychic in order to experience the change in bodies. I was just reading an article in the paper about what sleeping meditations now do to people, especially this Ambien, which is a very dangerous drug in my estimation. I mean, you sleepwalk, you drive the car, you don't know you're driving it. There's been deaths, there's been drownings, there's been burnings, amputations. There's even been suicides on the drugs. And why do we mention it? Because many human beings have trouble sleeping for whatever reason.
Yeah, I do at times, for sure. And so do you.
And that may be because of the state of the active mind. Gathered together with the molecules of the body and the just the energy levels of bringing one down into a state of sleep. Sometimes it's recommended. Some people do cat naps and sleep about a half hour. They say you shouldn't sleep more than a half hour napping.
Yeah, because it makes you really groggy. And
not
it's
only
not,
that, but then you lose your rhythm at night.
Right.
But the body needs a rhythm. And if you typically go to bed at the same time every night and wake up at the same time every day, you're telling your body what the rhythm is. And that's a more of a base biological way of, organic way of looking at how to sleep. When your mind is too active and you just can't go under, it's almost, you know what it's like? It's like it's like trying to dive under the water in a pool or in the ocean, and you're wearing a life preserver, or you're wearing some kind of inflated apparatus, and you just can't get down there. That's kind of like going into sleep. Some people just can't go under deep enough because their brain is inflated with too much energy.
Well,
their body won't settle down.
Then how to explain those who can go under and then wake up in the middle of the night? So they have enough energy to be able to enter sleeping state, but then wake up in the middle of the night.
Because breath actually requires breath and a different regulation of breath.
Yeah.
So if you are attuned to deep breathing, a lot of people who snore.
It's funny you're mentioning this because I have to tell you something, but go ahead.
But yeah, it has a lot to do with breath.
Because I woke up early this morning, probably around 5:30, and I didn't think I was going to go back to sleep, and that's exactly what I did, in part to try to go back to sleep. I was, breathing and focusing on my breath very intently, and I did ultimately fall back to sleep.
There is a deliberate...
I actually did it deliberately today. So
there is a deliberate and obvious way of breathing in order to induce sleep. But it's just like, if you're going to go under the water, you take a deep breath. You don't take a shallow breath. So think about it. First of all, in entering the sleep stage, it's good to take deep breaths, not aggressively aggravated breaths, like you're gulping like a goldfish, but to take deep, deep, quiet breaths.
Well, and
what it does is it brings oxygen to the body and the brain, so the brain doesn't go into panic mode in sleep. A lot of people, whether they realize it or not, they don't fall asleep because they go into panic mode about sleep, that they're going to die. They're not going to be able to breathe. So a good way to look at sleep is to take deep, deep, deep breaths, which also increases the attitude of the third eye, and then in that case, the attitude of venturing out into the astral realm where you don't wake up in the middle of the night or have a troubled sleep, so to speak.
But often the attitude of deep breaths is misconstrued. And so people think that they're breathing deeply and they're really breathing shallow. And actually, when you're in a sleeping state, the body is breathing by itself. You're not doing anything. So to take deep breaths that doesn't require a big, that's not a deep breath.
No, the breath has to go down. The breath, you take breath, but the attitude is you bring the breath, you take the breath and go downward.
Right, it is downward.
You have to
all
go downward,
the muscles,
like an elevator.
Intercostal muscles, all the diaphragm descends.
You don't
when you're breathing deeply.
That's what I'm saying. You don't do it like a goldfish. You can do it in a way that's not even hardly visible. But the area. Now, let's say you're laying on your side and you're laying in bed. What you do is you breathe in, and then instead of exhaling, you slowly take that breath and take it down into the lower parts of your body, which now being in the psychic realm, that starts to accelerate the energy of the mind in terms of a sleep state. So what you do is you breathe in and you visualize the breath going into your brain, and in the layers of your brain, you're visualizing it going deep into your brain, not just down into your lower stomach, but deep into your brain. Now that's where the third eye enters the picture, which works in cooperation with the body, because the third eye has two levels. One, it's the third eye of the soul, which is strictly just soul-based, astral body-based. But because the third eye and the soul and the astral body have a habitation within the physical body, there's got to be a dialogue in some respects. So in terms of that dialogue, yes, you have the body breath that goes down to the stomach and down deep, quietly, silently, like the movie Run Silent, Run Deep. And then you have the visual energy and the physical sensation of that same breath going down deep into the brain, almost traveling, elevator descending.
Well, I was just going to say it's a good reminder for me when I do, I mean, even in waking state, not just trying to go to sleep, but to focus the breath into the brain in order to activate the third eye, because it's easy to be distracted in certain, you know, when you're doing meditative type exercises, you know. It's not exactly meditation, activating the third eye. It's not exactly meditation, but your mind can wander. So focusing the breath in that direction, brain-wise, is an important piece.
You know, an example, a nice example that's the most recent example that's been visible is the show Jeopardy.
Oh.
Now, the guy has won over $1 million. He's the second highest winner in the history of Jeopardy. And when you watch him...
Well, he's won the second most shows. He's been...
Yeah,
he has the second most shows, second most money.
He also
money.
Won the highest amount in any given show.
Right. He's... And I don't know what...
130,000.
Yeah,
so,
anyway.
But he's got over a million.
Yeah.
So anyway...
Obviously, we're following the show.
He's a gambler of sorts.
Professional sports gambler.
But he does understand the strategy. There's a strategy behind what he's doing. So there's a mind strategy going on in terms of how he does this. He goes for the bigger amounts first, and then he tries to get the daily double and that kind of thing. But there's another thing that I've noticed he does, and I was somewhat intrigued by it. The clicker, you have to learn how to manipulate that clicker and know how to operate it in order
so
to
you
be
can
the first one
served. Buzz one first.
Now, you look at the other players, and they're like, with their hands,
I know.
And they're all tensed up.
He's very relaxed in his, completely
very,
relaxed.
You can't, I looked at him, I thought he was sleeping.
Yeah.
Number one, his eyes are so slanted.
Well, he's half Japanese.
Oh, I don't mean it that way, but,
yeah, but
his eyelids are so slanted, it looks like he's falling asleep on the show. He shows no emotion.
No, he's very, very focused.
He's very focused, he shows no emotion. He clicks that thing without any body, apparently visible body movement. And when he's thinking of an answer, he might contort his face a bit. He kind of, what he does is he kind of lifts one side of his lip and it looks like it's going, reaching up to one eye. And then you kind of look like he's thinking to himself, like, I don't know what I'm doing. And he comes up with the answer because he's got this trunk load of information in his brain, and he's able to retain it. Well, maybe he's very, very acutely intelligent, and he has excellent memory and coordination. Having said that, in our journey, it's the same thing. At least in my shoes, when I'm giving a reading and I'm going all over the map about people's lives and going into the astral realm and listening to spirits, having a dialogue with somebody while I'm also simultaneously having a dialogue with something in the astral realm, there's no movement, hardly any movement in my body.
Right, you wouldn't know that all these things were going on.
Yeah.
At all.
So I
your brain is working on multiple levels.
So I identify
simultaneously.
I identify with him to that extent because when I'm operating, there's no great display of emotion. And if I'm looking at somebody with the third eye, I'm just totally quiet. You wouldn't even know I was doing anything. So there's this intense concentration of energy that's controlled by the consciousness of breath. You're consciously thinking of your breath in such a way that your consciousness controls your breath, not your body, but the consciousness of your mind controls your breath. Now, this is the doorway to omniscience. In Jeopardy, he's omniscient. He's omniscient and he's omnipresent because he's able to gather all facts. He can answer questions on all levels. He can work his hand with that clicker.
Which is hard, I think, and especially the fact that he's 34 years old versus, like, you know, 65. I mean, his reflexes are,
his reflexes,
you know,
are very good.
Excellent.
I'm at my age, I'm lucky if I can know how to do the toilet thing with the handle.
But no, your reflexes are good. I mean, you're driving. So they do kick in when you need them to kick in.
Yeah, there's been some funny things in driving with cars, and I just turn real quick and right back in.
Where we've all just been killed. Yeah.
But I'm a little alert driver anyways, because to me, that's a death-defying maneuver to drive anyways. But the idea of being totally in control. And don't forget, he's also strategizing what numbers to pick. He's got probably awareness of what his opponents are doing. And he can be way behind. He shows no panic. And he quickly comes back.
Yeah. On a recent episode, he wagered everything, which he often does. This is one of his strategies. He hits a daily double, and then he bets it all. And he was at like $10,000 in the first round of play. There's two rounds in Jeopardy. And he lost everything. He got the answer wrong. But he came back. And I mean, that night his total was like $45,000 or something by the time he reached the final Jeopardy round. It's pretty remarkable that he can lose and maintain focus.
Well, in my very early, I've been doing readings for over 50 years, actively speaking, well over 50 years. And in my first years of doing readings, if I got something wrong, I would start to panic a little bit. Now, if I get something wrong, I just take a breath, and 10 minutes later, I got 10 things right. Validations. So, you know, there's a certain strategy, too, about being a good psychic, because you're not strategizing to manipulate and confuse and make believe something. You're strategizing in order to find the right vibration wherein you can receive the right information. And sometimes that is a bit of a struggle for any psychic.
It is. And sometimes it's a struggle. I mean, sometimes you can become overwhelmed with emotion that you're getting things right and get real excited, lose focus because of that. That would be me. Sometimes that happens. Slamming my hand down on the table last radio show. But, harnessing your emotions is a good idea. And we have some callers, but no one has hands raised. So callers, 519-917. If you'd like to speak with us, please let us know. Okay, Jennifer. Hi.
Hi, Neil and Kristen. How are you?
Fine, thanks. How are you?
Hi.
Good. I was questioning, do you have... do our guides change over time, depending on what we need?
Do guides change over time? Well, you have one guide throughout your life. People think there's like all these different guides. And yes, it's possible to have more than one energy from the spirit realm helping you in the course of a lifetime. But you're assigned one guide. There's one guide that is with you from actually in all your lifetimes, from birth to death in each of the lifetimes. But yes, there can be other entities that come and help in different circumstances.
That's absolutely true. But generally speaking, Jennifer, a guide was once a human being who has transcended all earthly karma. They've transcended the body entirely. And now they're assigned in the soul and spirit and astral realm to be a guide for other human beings. So they're kind of graduates. And then
they have to work. They go transcend and have to work.
Well, they're in the astral realm. they're in the astral realm, so it's not war. It's an energy.
Well,
it's an energy.
So.
And these guides can be in forms.
She's laughing.
They can be in various forms. They can be somebody you knew. They can be somebody you didn't know. But you're assigned a guide like a tutor. And you group with this guide for indefinite periods of lifetimes. Now, other guides can come in. You can have guides that come in and out. They can be angels. They can be spirits. They can be alien type things. They can be, there's just a whole number of other guides that can come in and aid you. They can even be people that you knew that crossed over that are temporarily next to you and feeling you through. They don't have as much power. But they can be there. So that's why people say, you know, oh, my grandmother's with me or something like that. But you do have one specific guide. And then above that, Jennifer, you have a presiding assemblage of guides that are in higher order. Now, these are really special guides there. And then you get into the element of angels, which were never an occupation of the human body. They're totally celestial from the origins of their time existence. And you have those energies. So there's a whole cast of characters, but your main guide is a permanent guide. And when you sleep, you talk to your guide. You may not remember it. Obviously, most of us don't. Each time you die, you go into the astral realm and have direct conference with your guide. And classrooms and discussions and things like that. But your guide is also limited, Jennifer, in terms of how much they can deal with. Think of it as a trainer with a boxer. They can't jump into the ring with you. They can only have those moments when the bell rings or when you go to sleep, and they can talk to you and converse with you until you have to go back into the conscious state of the body and start working on your own.
And I would say that the more one is involved in a spiritual walk in his or her life, there's going to be more involvement of other entities, you know, angels, spirits, aliens. That's going to be more intense if the person's spiritual path is more intense. I mean, if someone's completely, you know, in the physical, you know, they're only concerned with physical things in life, they're not going to have as much involvement with, you know, angels and spirits aren't going to be, you know, gathering around them, communicating with them.
You know, about 15 years ago, that movie the first movie, Karate Kid, came out. And I enjoyed it because I thought of that Pat Morita, or whatever his name
is. Pat Morita.
As he was like a guide. You see, that the character had only one trainer. And that trainer was his sole trainer, and he assisted and helped him. He couldn't jump into the ring, but that was a pretty crude but still effective metaphor, an example of what a guide is like. And so I hope that kind of briefly answers your question, unless you have another question you want to ask us regarding this.
Oh, it's more of a comment, I had one guide, they called it a gatekeeper, but then one day, that guide was just gone. When I tried to contact that guide, gone, and then someone said, oh, you know, your guides change over time, and I'm all right, whatever. But then with angels, I've actually physically seen them twice, and they come as a group of two to get me out of precarious situations where I could possibly die. So it's, and they assume the weirdest human form, like hillbillies once, and then two guys dressed in leather and chains driving a white Ford Escort.
There's two things. There's two things. A gatekeeper is like the changing of the guards. They're not permanent. A gatekeeper... Mm-hmm. And I actually wrote a book all about a gatekeeper. But a gatekeeper is an energy form, sometimes a spirit, sometimes a human transformed into astral body, and they maintain the portals. They maintain the elements of going to and from, and they are somewhat of a guide. They can take you somewhat through a bridge, but they're mainly, that's why they're called gatekeepers.
But
they
that wasn't her personal guide.
No, that wasn't
not
her,
your personal
guide.
Because...
You're not going to find a permanent, it's like the changing of the guard. You're not going to find a permanent keeper of the gate typically in any one lifetime. The other thing about the ridiculous kind of an amusing kind of matter of what you saw in your field of energy, our brains sometimes can't grasp what's going on in the astral realm. So the brain starts to twist and turn to try to make sense. So we do that sometimes with images. You know, we look at a weird image and our brain tries to make it look like something, try to assemble it. Our brains are geared that way. So oftentimes when you have a ridiculous kind of vision, what you're doing is your brain is trying to contort the astral image that is totally incomprehensible into something it can apply as a simile or a metaphor or an example. And that's what happens there. That's why it seems so bizarre. And, you know, Back to the Future, like with some zany character coming out of a car. But that's, I hope that kind of answers that question.
Oh, that's really interesting, because I'm wondering, like, now, not that I'd ask him, but I wonder if my ex-husband saw the same two physical people that I saw, because I didn't really compare notes with them after the fact, but
sorry to interrupt. This was a situation where there was some kind of danger, impending danger that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's kind of like the play Harvey, or somebody who has in the movie, somebody has a direct connection with a ghost, and the ghost says, "Would you want me to be able to appear to your friend?" Sometimes a spirit or an astral form will make a decision to appear to more than one person. So in all actuality, Jennifer, a spirit can be exclusive to one person's vision, but that same entity can, for whatever reason, appear to multiple eyes, other people. And sometimes there's a simultaneous thing. If a spirit form penetrates into the physical realm, then that would be like four people saw the same ghost. They all saw it, because the energy of the entity was so intense that it appeared in physical form and was visible to any eye that happened to be there. If there is a sleeping episode and you have a dream and somebody else has the same dream, then that spirit form is omnipresent and can appear to both sleeping forms in essentially a common area of the astral realm, because the astral bodies will both, of the sleeping partners, will both merge and congregate on the same astral plane, specifically speaking, and then have an encounter with any given spirit.
Interesting. Okay, that's very interesting.
Well, hope that helps, Jennifer.
Yeah, that helps a lot.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Take care.
Okay, we're going to bring this caller on. 917, hello. Nobody's there.
Disembodied spirit. See, that's another example of a spirit calling the show and can't manifest.
And we both saw that the caller was there. Manifested in this physical realm to a certain degree, but not completely. Okay.
Something visual, but not auditory.
Right. Okay. All right, where were we?
Well, that's the other thing about think about it. We have a dream.
We have a dream. You Martin Luther King?
Any person.
Junior?
No, I know a guy named Wee, and I was saying Wee had a dream. Person.
917's back.
Okay, quickly. Person can have a dream.
Yeah.
And you don't really hear voices in your dream, but in the dream you hear people talking. Where's that coming from?
Right.
We'll get back,
back to that in a moment. Okay, 917. Hi. Nothing.
That maybe they're talking and they can't.
Yeah, it's very strange.
But you know, is it the imagination of hearing a voice in a dream? Because you can have, you know, we all know we have dreams and people talk. There's sounds. Is it the imagination? Is it the ability for the brain to create a sensation of language so that in a sleeping state, you're actually hearing language, but you're not really hearing it, but the brain is recording and is sort of in a facsimile, a replica of energy, creating a voice in your brain? Or do you actually go into sleep and the third ear opens up? Now, my gravitational pull to me, for me, in explaining how to create new words while I'm speaking,
it's fantastic.
Yeah, Norm Crosby did that. He was very good at that. But we have a third ear. We have a third ear, and it's either inactive or active. In some respects, we all get a taste of it at some point. But that third ear allows, that third ear allows a person to also hear energies from the astral realm. So that's when you hear the element. Now, most people experience it as the consciousness of just our thought form. You know, we can talk to ourselves. We're constantly, think about it. We constantly
and,
are talking to ourselves.
And differentiating that can be very challenging. I mean, a lot of people think they're hearing spirits and messages, and it's really their inner voice or whatever,
well,
their brain working.
I'll tell you why. Because the corridor to that is the thought form. And when you have a thought form, think about it, it's a thought that takes form and you hear it. You don't have to speak it, but you hear it. So thought has sound. Thought has sound. First of all, it has sound because it's just our consciousness in thought form speaking to us. So we have this inner dialogue. In literature, it's called the interior monologue. In life, it's just called inner thinking. We're thinking all the time. We walk, basically, how many of us walk down the street, we go, I can't stand that person. We don't say it, but we think it. Or, oh my God, that's so beautiful, that sunset. We don't say it, but we think.
Or there's all kinds of things that run through your mind as you're walking down the street. You know, what needs to happen later in the day, cooking dinner, whatever.
Whatever it may be.
Right.
But that thought form, it takes on exactly that, a form. And sometimes we hear it according to the exact vocal tone of our voice. When there's no tone, there's no vocal. But we can imagine someone talking to us that we know, and we hear and we thought form them talking to us and even hear the way they speak, but we don't hear anything. That's a third ear. That's the primitive
beginning of the third ear. But the danger of that is when conducting readings, for instance, there are many people that conduct readings and their third ear is only listening to their inner voice. That's the problem. And so separating the ego from the third ear or what the third eye is an important step if you're trying to develop your psychic ability, because many people are in their ego when they're doing readings and you really do have to separate it.
Well, that's
you have to separate
the confusion,
it.
That thought form corridor, that boulevard where everything travels, that's where we get confused, because the energy of other entities and spirits and guides will use that in order to land itself and implant itself on the third ear. The only difference is that you have to be, really have to train yourself to understand the difference between one, a sound you hear, two, a sound that's in your own thought form, and then three, a sound that comes from other thought form. It's not your thought form. So that's where the distinction is that you're speaking of. When you hear a guide or a spirit, you are not hearing your thought form.
Right.
You're hearing another thought form.
But sometimes when you do hear it, whether it's just psychic information the mind is able to perceive, or a spirit or guide, there may be something that goes on in the body, like, you know, a feeling within the body. So it's hard to separate it. I mean, you know, when you're experiencing a feeling and hearing something that's psychic, it's still, you know, differentiating whether it's your mind or something actually psychic is challenging.
Back in the 60s,
can be challenging.
There was this movie, very flawed, but still it was a joyful film called The Bible. John Huston directed it. And in the movie, John Huston played Noah. And Noah, in the scene with Noah, Noah listens to the voice of God. Later, Abraham, George C. Scott, he hears it too. But Noah hears the voice of God. And he has this schizophrenic conversation, seemingly, because he's shouting and he's talking. Same thing with Abraham having to kill his son, Jacob. But they hear the voice of God. Also, if we go back to, you know, there's a symbol. Is the Bible fiction or fact? Where is it located in the library? Well, it's really located in its own Dewey Decimal System. That's neither fiction nor fact. That's where the Bible's located. But
in the neither fiction nor fact section?
Yeah, there's anthologies and things like that. And the Bible will be in religious study. So religious
study. So that's
study
more nonfiction.
Takes
then,
on
then
that
it is
aspect,
fiction.
Kind of that thing. But it has a distinct Dewey Decimal System number. But in the attitude of, now let's go back to the Garden of Eden. God walked in the Garden of Eden and spoke. Now, did he actually appear? If we look at this either fictitiously or realistically, or was he a voice in the garden? But those voices that speak, many times it's depicted
in
cinema as just a voice.
Right, but it was depicted, I think, in the Bible as a voice.
Yeah, as a voice.
Not him appearing in a physical form.
And his face was on the surface of the sea, and his voice. So and that sea could be astral realm. It could be the energy of that field. So in the attitude of hearing, there is a distinct difference. So when you hear, when I hear a voice from the other side, I get chills. I
see,
know
that's what I'm saying.
Me.
So that was my point. There's a physical, your body has a physical response to hearing a voice. So it's interesting.
Well, it's developed. I'm immune to it now. So I don't get the chills anymore.
Oh.
I just hear the voice. But
that's
I'm so accustomed to the direction of it that I know what it is. After 50 years, you're going to know.
But what I'm saying is that was your experience hearing voices, is having chills. There's sparrows, I'm sorry, outside the window.
trying to tell us how it's done.
But That's what's interesting to me, is that you had a physical sensation that accompanied the voices, probably for many, many years.
Well, when I was a little boy, you know, they took me to the therapist, the psychiatrist and everything. And I said, I heard voices, and the doctor looked at me like, okay, you heard voices. Well, what are they telling you? In a very sarcastic way. And then I would express things about the doctor's life that there's no way a 6-7-year-old would know, and the doctor would go, what? They thought it was something acute in my brain, some kind of thing going on, but then it became a study with doctors that, how did he know? I went on a boat over the weekend with three people. One was named Michael, and the other one was my wife, Sarah. How would an eight-year-old know that? And so it became intriguing to that person because, but back then, my spirit guides and the people and the energies that I talked to would also appear to me in form. I would see them standing in front of me. And so I had this, you know, like a lot of other psychics, I imagine, had a unique experience growing up. So I was accustomed to the sound of otherworldly and other astral entities in terms of how I incorporated it into my mind and listened to it and had conversations and simultaneously. Yes, it got me into a lot of trouble. And as a younger person, I was totally in conflict with the physical world and in trouble all the time. But nonetheless, I kept steadfast and stayed with it and developed a rapport with spirits and guides that, you know, on a human level, you try to be as accurate as you can. It's not always perfect because sometimes you can get it a mixture of a good spirit, a bad spirit. I mean, there's all different kinds of things. You misinterpret something the other person you're giving a reading to does that disrupts things. There's a saboteur thing going on. There's karma. I mean, it's like driving in a car. I'm going to drive from here to there. It's 20 miles, and I'll see you in a half hour. What do you mean I'll see you in a half hour? You got to take account of street lights and people walking out in the street and bicycle riders and
traffic
and crossing over the line and traffic. There's so many things that we have to consider. That's why it drives me crazy to drive. That's harder for me to do than doing a reading. I hate it. But the idea that that in the astral realm, you're surrounded by all these variables. I mean, you yourself would know in your course of discovering new things in the astral realm, what you've glimpsed out there that you never even thought before was there.
Right, and the difference in the journey of developing psychic ability, even though I had glimpses of and psychic experiences throughout my life, obviously there was something in me, a DNA, that had talent for this type of work, but because it wasn't developed, I mean, compared to where I'm at now, I mean, there's no comparison, and definitely it takes dedication, practice, commitment, and still, you know, you continue the process of growth.
Yeah,
it's never ending.
The one has to accustom themselves. So, you know, it's much like somebody who becomes accustomed to wild animals, and they kind of tame a wild animal, not tame, but they have a rapport with them. And now the wild animal comes up to them and they pat the wild animal and they're feeding them and they're playing with the wild animal. It's the same thing Jane Goodall did with the chimpanzees. Hours, months, years of just sitting there, letting the chimpanzees become accustomed and acclimated to her presence. And until there was finally that first touch by a little baby chimpanzee that was so famously captured in National Geographic. The same thing goes with spirits. If you're calm and open and relaxed and loving and giving, the spirits will gravitate towards you. They just do.
They
because
do.
They have a need to interact with human beings.
Well, and I mean, my interaction, there's an interaction that I have with spirits on a level that I can't really talk about on the radio show, but it's a definite interaction and communication that goes on. It's been going on for quite a while. And that's one level. But also, I mean, even in dream state, prior to starting to really actively develop my third eye, you know, my dreams were probably psychological. Maybe there were some astral dreams. I mean, we all travel in the astral realm when we sleep. But the activity now that happens in the places that I go, I mean, I'm constantly surrounded by people, spirits that I've never encountered before, spirits, souls that are seeking help. So, you know, traveling into different areas of the astral realm happens nightly for me.
And then what I'm hearing, you get now you're getting validations, because when you sleep and you have dreams, you wake up and then something happens.
Yeah, I have this.
According to the dream.
Exactly, yeah.
So you start going, you know, after a while, after many, many years, this becomes not only commonplace, but it expands into all kinds of areas, because the dream world offers us access to psychic energies,
yeah,
where our conscious brain isn't getting in the way.
Right. Recently, I'm not going to go into the whole explanation of what happened two nights ago. I had a dream, and in the next day, I mean, it was like I had gone into the future, basically, in the dream, and then the day unfolded in such a way that was in accordance with my dream that I had. And there were numerous things that occurred.
That's the advantage. When you enter the astral realm, it's like having a book in front of you where you can jump
skip
over to the
pages.
Because a book is meant to be read cover to cover, but nothing is going to stop a reader from jumping all over a book. You can go to page 200, back to page one, and so in the time scheme, and this was also in accordance with Einstein and relativity and time travel and the bending of energy, we can look at all moments simultaneously and jump. Think, you open up a book, you're on page 10. In 2 seconds, you flip over on page 20 and you're reading. You're jumping across that book. That's what's so fascinating about a hardcover book. When you can feel it in your hands and you're jumping, and even the energy of the tree that based the paper, you've got so many connections going on there and so much to be involved in. Not just the element and attitude of words and sentences and paragraphs and themes and the beauty of language, but you've got this whole energy field within that book. That's why I'm a great book collector. Love books, but I love the content of books. It's the same thing in the astral realm. You can jump, literally, because you're in your astral body, from one spectrum of time to another. And not only that, but from one lifetime to another lifetime.
You sound like you're like a book on tape reader now.
No.
It's very...
Yeah, scotch tape.
Your inflection is very dramatic.
Because, you know, I mean, it is dramatic to enter the astral realm. And the very first time you experience time travel, not within your own lifetime, when you go back to maybe you were 5 or 10, or you see yourself as an old person, but when you first jump in and you discover, my God, I'm not even in my time zone. I've entered not only another time zone, but another lifetime where I was alive in that time zone. Now that gets trippy. When I first did that, I would wake up in the morning and I wouldn't be able to converse with anybody for about 6 hours. I was mesmerized by the experience.
Something else, you know, we have probably about 5 minutes left, but something else I wanted to mention is the trust level that you established with spirits and angels and the guides that you're involved with. Obviously, we all have one guide, but if you're someone who is deeply, a psychic like yourself, for instance, there are multiple guides.
You can have more than one guide.
Yeah.
So I have 3 or 4 guides. Where that, yes, you can have that.
So
you can have multiple, you can have many guides.
Okay. So, but that said, you know, there's many things spirits have communicated to me about people that are in confidence that I would not repeat. And in a reading, there's often information that's given where it's not appropriate necessarily to share with the person that you're talking to. And so establishing a trust level with spirits that are communicating with you, I think, is very important, because not all the information is meant to be shared. It isn't. And you have to be discriminating and use discretion about what is relayed to a client or a subject that you're working with.
Sometimes I'm told things and I'm not allowed to reveal them, so I don't. And sometimes the person I'm speaking to, not the spirit, but the human being, can be in great distress, but if I'm told by a spirit not to speak, so it takes up the attitude of obedience. I'm very obedient to the spirits that I hear. I don't argue with them. I don't demand things from them. I sometimes request sincerely on behalf of others, but I'm very careful about the vibrational energy. I kind of think of a spirit like a bird on my hand, feeding from my hand. If I jerk too much, the bird will fly away. So I'm very, very careful. And even in our lifetime, Chris and I, we have this wild cat that did not trust us. She didn't trust us and all blah, 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 blah. And now we can hold her, take her anywhere. We can take her into areas that she's not sure of, and she's purring. Why? Because she's come to trust us over time by the behavioral patterns that we've exhibited with her, that we have earned her trust. That's a common, you earn the trust of spirits. You have to think of them that way.
Gosh, and even birds in our environment have earned our trust too.
Oh, yeah,
and,
birds,
you know,
flying all over.
Speaking of birds, but yeah.
Yeah. Anything, lizards, anything that you build a trust with, any living form or any astral form, and you consider that they're not there upon your command. You're there upon the absolute gift of presence. And in that presence, you know, this is hallowed ground, take off your shoes. When you're involved in a spirit form, you have to show respect to that form. I've never experienced anything to the contrary.
Yeah. So, well, any final thoughts for the day?
No, I hope that kind of fills the time. We only had one caller today, but on the 700th show, maybe it was just time to speak up a little bit.
Yeah. Okay. Well, everybody, we hope you join us again. Everybody, all one of you that was here today, but there's probably listeners. So we do hope that you join us on Wednesday at 9 a.m. Pacific, 12 p.m. Eastern. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye. Happy Cinco de Mayo.